The next case was, it was originally scheduled as number one, United States versus Koopman.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Carrie Connor, and I'm here today on behalf of Brad Koopman. The appeal in this case, Your Honors, involves a challenge of the sentence that Mr. Koopman received, 151 months, and that is the low end of the guideline range in this case. We have challenged the sentence that the district court imposed in two primary ways. First, we've challenged the overall reasonableness of that sentence. And secondly, we have also challenged the sentence in that the district court did not provide meaningful discussion and findings regarding the two primary issues raised by the defendant at his sentencing and pursuant to the considerations of 3553A. Specifically, in the district court, the defendant had raised the issue of the reasonableness of the guideline calculations under 2G2.2. In doing that, we relied extensively on the Stabenow article, which has been discussed by the Seventh Circuit in a few different cases, but has been widely used and has been accepted in other district courts. Not only did the defendant file a brief regarding the Stabenow article, which in fact challenged the validity, did not challenge the validity, but challenged the reasonableness of the sentencing guidelines for child pornography cases, specifically challenging that those guidelines were based on empirical data or scientific study as required and understood under the Gall case and Kimbrough and other analysis of the importance of the sentencing guidelines.
Okay, but let me make a couple of comments. First of all, this isn't the longest-winded explanation from a district court judge I've ever seen, but the district court does touch on a number of the 3553A factors in his explanation. He notes harm to the victim. He notes deterrence, both specific deterrence and general deterrence. He looks at the past history. He looks at protection of society. He explicitly acknowledges this argument about the empirical evidence or perhaps lack thereof for 2G2.2, but he says, I find in this case the guidelines to be fair and reasonable based on the facts of this case. So I want you to think about that. And then secondly, I perceive, anyway, a slight disconnect between the arguments that Mr. Koopman is making and the gist of this statute, because Dr. Hillman keeps saying that he doesn't think Mr. Koopman is going to go out and predate against actual children. He's not going to molest children and so on. You know, good. As far as that goes, that's great. But the child pornography statute also assumes that the marketing and viewing and distribution of child pornography itself, even if you never in a million years touch a child, is already a harm to the child. And I don't see anything that really confronts that point.
Well, I believe that the arguments in presenting Dr. Hillman's testimony do go to the heart of the 3553A, because 3553A considers a variety of factors in determining what is the appropriate sentence for this defendant. Now, certainly the seriousness of the offense and how society and even Congress views the seriousness of the offense is relevant. And therefore, we are not arguing, as has been previously argued by certain defendants, that 2G2.2 is invalid. We have not argued that, but merely that it is not based on empirical and scientific study, and therefore, in taking the guideline into consideration, which does primarily focus on societal concerns regarding the child pornography statute, that the court has to also consider other 3553A factors, and that the guideline should not be weighed heavily because it is not grounded in empirical and scientific data.
How do we know that this district judge didn't do exactly that? He's looking at harm to the victim. He's looking at the fact that it's children and on. I mean, the things that I just mentioned.
Well, he may very well be looking at various aspects of 3553A based on his own conclusions. However, we had 2 days of hearings that surrounded the issue of the mental health testimony. And we also had extensive briefing on 2G2.2. Under Seventh Circuit law, the district court has an obligation to not only cite that those things occurred or were in the courtroom, but to actually do some meaningful analysis. And going back to your first question, where I was headed was, this is not a matter of attempting to ignore the seriousness of the offense. However, in considering the 3553A factors, amenability to rehabilitation, whether or not an individual is a danger to society, whether or not rehabilitative programs are available to that individual, vocational programs, all of those are equal considerations. And in this case, where you have a defendant who has, there's no evidence, has ever harmed a child directly.
Well, but I'm not sure that that's relevant. I mean, the district court is absolutely in line with the statute if the district court says it's actually the participation in the child pornography market that's already the harm to whichever children were involved in the making of that material.
Well, then the question becomes, though, what is the appropriate sentence for this individual? Is the appropriate sentence 151 months, which we presented to the court, which was not analyzed by the court, that is not rested in any kind of scientific or empirical value? Or is it the 60 months, which is the mandatory minimum, when you have a well-qualified, the district court finds a well-qualified expert who is telling the court two important things. One, that what this defendant really needs is therapy. And if he's given therapy, he is a zero to low risk for not only...
Well, you say highly qualified expert, but his expertise is not necessarily in what he was testifying about. He only dealt with 10, as I remember, 10 cases like this.
Actually, the 10 cases that were dealt with were actually federal internet child pornography cases. The record reveals that the expert we presented, Dr. Hillman, actually sat on the Illinois Committee for developing diagnostic and therapy programming for violent sexual predators. If in fact someone's expertise...
That's not what we're not talking about, a violent sexual predator here, are we?
But that is the concern, Your Honor, and I think that's an important concern. And I don't think it would be fair to say that when Congress developed penalties for possession, receipt, or distribution of child pornography, they weren't concerned that that individual is a danger to the community. And in fact,
I've heard argument in this court many times that the danger to the children is the production and distribution of child pornography. Not that the individual possessing it might be a threat to a particular child, but the whole system that provides that material is created by the distribution.
Well, and no one has questioned the seriousness of the offense. The issue becomes, what is the appropriate sentence for this defendant? And in this case, it is very important. If, in fact, in the Seventh Circuit, we're going to take the issue seriously about whether or not the guidelines are applied as a presumption, that other than, quote, looking at the filings on 2G2.2, the court found no additional findings or reached any conclusions whatsoever regarding the viability or the reasonableness of the guideline calculations. And that is an important consideration, especially when it's quite clear that simply raising the 100-to-1 crack ratio as an unreasonable basis for a higher sentence, when everyone in this room is likely to indicate that crack is a problem and a societal problem, but does that mean that the 100-to-1 ratio is the appropriate method of measuring a sentence? Here we have challenged 2G2.2, and the court did not discuss at all, other than saying that they had looked at the filings, how, in fact, that was weighed into this case.
Ms. Connor, if I could follow up on that. I'm sensing, if I understand your position correctly, that you're trying to navigate your way around Aguilar, Huerta, and Hufstadler by saying you're not challenging the validity of the guideline, but you're challenging its reasonableness. If that's correct, I guess I would be interested in hearing more about how you can avoid those cases that seem to say that the district court may but is not required to turn the sentencing hearing in essence, into a full exploration of the legislative history and the supporting social science or lack thereof for the guideline.
Well, in Hofstadler and Aguilar, the defense actually argued in those cases that the guidelines were constitutional, were invalid. I see my time is up.
Answer his question.
That were invalid, entirely invalid, and should not be considered in any way by the court. We never made that argument. What we did say is, in considering 2G2.2 in reference to all of the other 3553A factors, the court had to be aware that there is substantial evidence that 2G2.2 does not meet the congressional mandate of being based on empirical and scientific data. In fact, we provided through the Stabenow research and an article the information about that. Now, that wasn't saying to the court, ignore 2G2.2. However, in applying 2G2.2, the court had an obligation to make an analysis of why the guideline reached by 2.G2.2 was in fact the appropriate sentence. In this case, the court never analyzed at any place in the record why a 151-month sentence was the appropriate sentence. I realize I'm out of time at this point.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bell?
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize to the court for the delay this morning. I saw the court's order denying defense counsel's motion to change the date of the oral argument and moving the argument up to the first argument in the call. I didn't notice that the order also moved the time up an hour, so I apologize for any delay this morning. This district court conducted a probing inquiry of the defense expert in this case. If the entire record is examined, the court actively engaged the defense expert in an inquiry and questioned the defense expert at length about the things that the defense expert testified about. The district court keyed on the defense expert's reliance on the forthright and engaging manner of the defendant, Koopman. And yet the facts set forth in the record show that Koopman lied to his family about his interest in child porn, and also show that Koopman lied to his own expert about his previous search for child pornography at Purdue University.
But why don't we see, we don't see anything other than kind of the summation of that. You know, the district court expresses concern that he says, I find the testimony somewhat suspect because it heavily relied on the truthfulness of the defendant. Dr. Hillman would be a very gullible psychologist if he thought that all of the people he talked to tell the truth. I mean, somehow he seems to have thought that this man was amenable to rehabilitation.
Well, this was touched on during defense counsel's argument. I don't know that this is an area where this expert really had his strength. This expert was a risk assessment expert for the state of Illinois. But he had dealt with precious few child pornography cases.
So when you say risk assessment, you're referring to the risk that he'd actually go molest a particular child?
Yes, yes, because he was a risk assessment expert for violent sexual offenders. And that's different than being an expert in child pornography and child pornography offenders. And I think that became apparent during the testimony of this expert. There were several areas in which this expert, I think, was failing. The expert was uninformed regarding Internet search terms for child pornography, for example. The expert did not conduct a probing inquiry of Koopman regarding his child porn activities. The expert didn't ask Koopman how often he observed child porn or how explicit the porn was that Koopman examined.
Was there ever any ultimate resolution about the alleged earlier incidents at Purdue? The judge says Lafayette University, but I think he means Purdue, right?
I think so. Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana.
With my Indiana colleagues here, I have to be very careful. Too.
District judge is an IU graduate.
It was an obvious slip of the tongue. So. We won't get into police, local police and university police relationships.
Koopman
But
tries.
Anyway, the judge just says the prior notice of possible problems by the whoever they are university investigation in 2001. But this, he never actually makes a finding of fact that there was a past.
I don't recall if the district court judge in so many words made that finding. He may have. I can't point the court to specific spots in the record where he made that explicit finding. Maybe it's implicit in the district court judge's observation that Koopman lied to his expert about his prior foray into child porn on this prior incident. With regard to the prior incident, though, the facts of the record established, I think, that Koopman did, in fact, deliberately access child porn at Purdue University.
But there's some messiness about it. I mean, apparently, I guess, the computer shows the child porn, but he said it was pop-ups or something like that.
Koopman tried to play this off that it was pop-ups that came up on the computer without his causing them to come up on the computer.
And the computer would have registered visiting the website, even if it had been pop-ups.
But the search terms were, there was no doubt where those came from, right?
Exactly, Your Honor. The computer expert, the forensic expert, testified that, sure, there might be pop-ups on the computer, but my analysis also showed that there were search terms that were deliberately typed in. And those had to be typed in.
Lolita something or other, teen Lolita.
Yes, there are several of them. And they had to be deliberately typed in by the person using the computer. That shows a specific search for child porn by the person using the computer. And the forensic expert testified that even though there may be pop-ups, there's no way those could account for the search terms which had to be deliberately typed in. So I think that resolves the factual question of whether Koopman actively and deliberately and intentionally looked for child porn in this prior incident. The district court paid attention to the fact that that Koopman lied to his own expert about this Purdue University incident, that the expert relied on Koopman's family, interviews with Koopman's family, who were also duped by Koopman when he lied to them about his interest in child porn. The district court, in addition to the things that the court on oral argument has already noticed, the observations that the district court made, in addition to those, the district court commented upon Koopman's repeated return to viewing child porn and the quantity of child porn that Koopman had. So the district court had before it a plethora of facts that entitled the district court to reject the conclusion made by this expert. And that's the district court's job, is to weigh the evidence and reach that decision, as long as the district court makes a well-considered decision, and I think the district court did here. The procedure was proper. The district court actively engaged the expert in questioning, and the district court had plenty of facts on the record to support the district court's decision. The government quotes in its brief the case of U.S. versus Shannon that indicates the district court need not address every 3553A factor in checklist fashion. Also, the case of United States versus Alday at 542 Fed 3rd 571 says that although the district court did not explicitly reference every sentencing factor in 18 U.S.C. 3553A, it is clear from its discussion that it considered 3553A as well as Alday's particular arguments. I think it's clear from the district court's discussion here and its lengthy engagement to the expert in questioning that the district court did, in fact, consider all of Alday's arguments. And this court has never required a district court. Koopman tries to focus on one paragraph in the district court sentencing order and says that paragraph doesn't encompass any analysis. But the district court's analysis is throughout the sentencing transcript. The district court throughout questioned the defense expert about all these things that I've talked about here today. So I think that the district court did, in fact, follow appropriate procedure, and the district court did make a well-considered judgment rejecting Koopman's arguments.
Well, I suppose your argument is if we can discern from the questions that the district judge asked, we know he's covering and thinking about those, right?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. The district court did, in fact, consider Koopman's arguments, and I think that's apparent throughout the record. As to whether the sentence is reasonable, although the district court doesn't apply a presumption of reasonableness on appeal, the court applies a rebuttable presumption of reasonableness. I quote this Sachsenmeier opinion, if I'm correct, if I'm pronouncing it. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I was about to apologize for not pronouncing it correctly.
Right,
so
it's a little easier than Mikitiuk.
The district court's sentence was within the guideline range, and so it's entitled to a rebuttable presumption of reasonableness on appeal. And, of course, the Hofstadler case addresses the defendant's other argument, and that is any argument that the defense counsel makes or that Koopman makes attacking the validity or the well-founded nature of the sentencing guideline that was applied here. That case indicates that the district courts are not to reassess the sentencing guidelines in lengthy sentencing hearings.
So they're not required to. They can.
They right? can. They can. And the district court did comment upon Koopman's argument regarding sentencing guideline 2G2.1, I think it was. The district court acknowledged that Koopman was making that argument, but rejected the argument. And as the court correctly notes, the district courts may reject the sentencing guidelines as inappropriate in a particular case, but they aren't required to do so. And this district court was not required to do so. And I think there is plenty of evidence in the record to support the judgment of the district court here. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You ran out of time, but I'll give you one more minute.
Okay, thank you. I think it's very important to look specifically at what the findings of the district court are in this case. And other than mentioning that the court had looked at the brief, looked at, the 2G2.2 briefing, there were no further factual findings or conclusions of law. And that's true if you look at the two full days of evidentiary hearing as well as any discussion from the court. In addition, I think it's important to note that the only factual finding regarding timing of Mr. Koopman's involvement with child pornography, which as we all know is illegal, it's not illegal to look at pictures of individuals who look like children. It is only illegal to look at child pornography. And in this case, the court found that that conduct only occurred within the six-month period related to the offense. In fact, Dr. Hillman told the court that Mr. Koopman had actually discussed looking at child pornography as early as 1999. So it is simply not accurate from this record to conclude that Mr. Koopman somehow duped Dr. Hillman.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.